We're a little pressed for time, so I'm going to give a very quick introduction to our next speaker. Unfortunately, we're going to have two speakers, but only one. Dwayne Gilley is here today. Ken Shipley of Numero Records could not be here, but Numero is one of the outstanding reissue labels of the last 10 years. They have done absolutely wonderful work in many genres, and especially, though, in the area of soul music. And Dwayne is here to talk about Numero's next release coming on August 16th, have I got that right? Which focuses on soul music here in Kansas City, the Forte label, which was home to Marva Whitney. And I would put in a plug for Marva Whitney right now. I would say between now and August 16th, don't wait to hear Marva Whitney then. Seek out her King album. She was really one of the greatest soul singers of all time. Soul was very much more than the story of just Motown in Detroit and Stax in Memphis. So without further ado, here is Dwayne Gilley.
I got two confessions to make before I say a word. After seeing Jim's presentation, I've decided, I don't know if I've sat through that much Kansas City music without drinking ever in my life. And then I own almost everything he played. I learned something about Everett Johnson I didn't know, so I really appreciated learning that today. Is everybody here, by show of hands, how many people are familiar with Numero's work in Chicago with the reissues that they do? Quite a few of you. Quite a few of you that aren't. How many in the room are familiar with Marva Whitney? So, yeah, a few hands in here as well. Or the Forte label. Anybody heard of the Forte? Fewer hands than anything on that. Numero is a reissue label primarily. If they've done any original recordings, I'm not aware of it. And they take a label's work, like in Kansas City with Forte, or a town like Miami or Detroit or Chicago or Dallas or Memphis, and maybe that label had a real good sense of energy. Maybe their recordings weren't much more than demos, or maybe they were actually releasable. It just depends on the label. And they put them together in a single or a double LP package. I know that they sell a package of 45. Seems like there's about 40 some odd of them that are $200 for the issue of a bunch of 45s that never really saw the light of day. It didn't get much distribution. So that's their real claim to fame, is they'll sell a couple thousand to 10,000 of a package that you've never seen before. So the first thing I'll tell you is Forte was a small label from Kansas City that was founded by Ellis Taylor and Marva Whitney. Ellis got his first thinkings of doing it around 1965. And by 67, 68, 69, he was putting it to work. And Marva Whitney was coming back from being on the road with James Brown for 3 years. And so they put a real effort between, I'd say really from 69 to 75 into Forte. Marva Whitney's daughter's with us today. It's Sherry Whitney right here up front. So I'm working with some real disadvantages for this presentation today. I've had two root canals and an extra surgery this week, so I'm not enjoying that too much, but I'm surviving. One of our presenters, the guy that probably knows Forte backwards in this part of the world, James Trotter, wasn't able to come and meet with us today. And the most important and what slowed up the release, we expected to have this product out by now in time for this conference so you could see it in its full glory instead of waiting until August 16th. But Sherry's mother, Marva, passed away December 22nd at 69. She just would have been her 70th birthday on May 1st. So that slowed us up. And when Chuck Haddix called and said, we really want to do a piece on this reissue from Numero, we had scheduled for Marva to come and do a Q&A, which would have been a lot more interesting than anything I'm going to tell you today, of course. We really would have loved to have Marva. Marva, to describe her, the best way I can describe her, is she was an extremely down-to-earth person that had one of the most ambitious drives I've ever seen. And that's usually those don't go together well in musicians. Usually you have somebody that's really pushy or really dominant. And in her case, she was very family-oriented. She had a substantial church background. And she was extremely grounded. Her career had started through the church because she had three brothers as triplets, two brothers as twins, Ray Jr., Raymond, and Ray. Rayford, excuse me, were the triplets. And then her mother had twins, which were Marvin and Melvin. And then as the pyramid goes, then we get Miss Marva Whitney after that. And they were a musical family, and they toured and played various places. Marva would become part of the Whitney Singers, where she would meet Sherry's father. He was the organist for their group. And eventually, as Jim showed you some slides and some music of the Tommy and the Derbies, by 1963, Marva had made the jump from being a gospel performer in her family's group to working with Tommy and the Derbies. And Jim said they really never recorded much. Well, it's because they were very busy and they were always in high demand. And if Ike and Tina Turner come through Kansas City and didn't want to bring a band, or if they wanted to go a little bit on the road, they would have Tommy and the Derbies or Lou Rawls. It's amazing amount of people that Tommy and the Derbies would back and play for. And James Gadsden, Tommy's brother, would go on to play drums for Bill Withers for Use Me Up and Lean On Me and some things like that. I think to this day, James Gadsden works with Paul McCartney. He's a high-demand drummer. He's up there with Earl Palmer, somebody in that category, if you're familiar with James Gadsden's name. So Marva had about 4 years' worth of work with the Derbies. And an old friend, how I got acquainted with Marva was through a man by the name of Clarence Cooper. And when I met Marva, I didn't realize that she was as much of a soul and a funk legend as she was. I knew that she'd been on some show bills around Kansas City for blues-oriented shows, but my focus of thought was more toward blues and jazz than toward the funk. So I didn't necessarily think that those things crossed each other, but they really do in Kansas City, maybe as much as other towns, but particularly here, that Marva had really, really old, deep roots into jazz and blues and gospel. Clarence Cooper knew I was working with a woman named Myra Taylor, and Myra had a career in the 30s and 40s, as Jim pointed out, as a swing singer and later as one of the early R&B acts. And Clarence started bringing Marva around to meet me for various things we were doing. I'm also a concert and a festival promoter in the Kansas City area. I'm basically a music activist that never makes any money. I usually try to lose less money is how it works out. But with Marva, she decided to adopt me because of how well she liked how I worked with Myra Taylor, that I got Myra back out for her last 14, 15 years of her career. And it wasn't very long later, I spotted, she made three albums for King and a whole slew of 45s for King Records. James Brown produced, you know, her albums for her with King. I started realizing this Marva Whitney is more than just somebody I know that's just a friend with me because of Myra Taylor. And to find out was that she'd been on the road from 67 into almost 70 with James Brown. Didn't have great experiences with that, but we won't cover it today. Her would-be husband, Ellis Taylor, that they founded Forte Records, started out as he'd gone to Korea. He was I think about 14 years older than Marva was. And he'd gone to Korea, and then he'd come home, and he had a TV repair business for a while and ended up working for Carter Broadcasting Company here in Kansas City, which is the black-owned radio station, KPRS. And I've been told KPRS stands for Keeping People Real Satisfied. But he worked for them, and he had done a couple of recordings for a DJ that wasn't exactly nice to his artists, and basically ripped him off. And he was young and green, and he was the technical side of things, and realized quick to get away from that guy. And over the next couple of years, he had this dream of starting his Forte label. Forte meaning strong and solid. Like fortitude, that's where Forte was coming at from him. And Marva had come off the road, and she'd had big success. So imagine being part of the biggest black show in America, let alone go overseas, to the power of that they brought James Brown to Boston when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and he did a series of shows, and that was one of the few towns in America that didn't have riots. So anytime James Brown rolled into town, it was a, you know, 5 to 20,000 people affair. And it's like the whole world stopped in the black community when they came to town. Marva was on the cover of Jet and Ebony. Yeah. She had received a lot of press. She had a big hit called It's My Thing, which was something that that they'd worked up to counterbalance what the Isley Brothers was doing with It's Your Thing. So she come off the road, and her and Ellis started this label in Kansas City called Forte, and I think we'll give you a music selection of Marva with Ellis Taylor, one of the few things Ellis ever recorded on.
Sissy.
My name's Marva.
When I drove up here, you acted like you didn't know me in front of your friends.
Your car is so raggedy, and it sounds like a train on snow tires. It's a bum's mobile.
What's a bum's mobile?
A car that bums drive.
You knowed me the other day when it was wet outside, and that wind was ripping you, and you slipped.
Well, you leapt that wonder up.
Folks are griping everywhere, you know? And you know we ain't doing so bad?
Yeah, I know, honey, but we ain't doing so good either.
Well, we paying most of all these bills, and you get your allowance, don't you?
That's not an allowance. I need just a little bit more than to call that an allowance, man.
Some folks are never satisfied. What are you going to be? I mean, what are you going to sacrifice?
I need more. You need more. Everybody need a little bit more. All people, I know, honey, need a little bit more.
You want more. You're eating and sleeping, ain't you? I can't work no two jobs.
Probably the biggest hit that they did for Marva was Daddy Don't Know About Sugar Bear, and it's a monster song, and that's the single that'll come out with the numero is a replica of that particular record. I should footnote and say, Kansas City, as Jim has said in different ways you'll know, is you know, goes back to ragtime. We were one of those first publishing centers, one of the biggest in the country, period. And women performers start out of that ragtime period and go through the blues and go through the jazz in this town. But then you get into the 20s and you get into the 30s, and Jim showed you quite a few records that are out there, but there's really, in retrospect, not that many Kansas City recordings. So I don't have an official memo to show you from the mob or from the mafia at all, but after you talk to enough musicians, you start to realize that a lot of Kansas City money went to build Vegas. So we were a very powerful city, and we were very well connected in that world. Chicago and New York and LA were very heavily mob-controlled towns, and you start to realize that we just weren't destined to be a big music town. We may have 2,000 union members, musician members in the 30s, for example, but there just wasn't going to be this synergy that's going to come out of Kansas City and make us a big recording boom town like other places got to be. By the 40s, after the war, you started seeing the small labels pop up, and we still had some recordings, but not too much. Kansas City has been primarily what I would call a demo town. Everybody makes sort of demo type recordings. Maybe they make a really nice recording, but they're always looking for a label that's going to pick them up. And this label, Forte, was designed similar to what Sam Phillips would do in Memphis or somebody like that, that he was always interested. Two of his artists was like Tony Ashley. He ended up taking him to do records with Decca, and unfortunately the same year he was shot and killed at the business or the shop that he worked in, the little market that he worked in. Another act that he took to Decca Records was the Rayons, and the Rayons also went to Decca, and unfortunately two of the three of the women members were pregnant at the time. And Decca agreed to do one record and one record only. So he had a couple of, if I had some Tony to play you today, I'd go ahead and play it, but I don't. Or do I have Tony Ashley on one of those cuts? Go ahead. Go ahead. Antoine Ashcroft, and of course they thought maybe Tony Ashley might be a little more appealing to the world. He was with a few recordings that exist. He would have been a great performer. So Forte sold some on the local scene around here, and they were really well polished records. The arrangements were really good. The musicians were really good. Some of the recordings are outstanding, and some of them are still very enjoyable, even though they maybe didn't rent the best of studios. They went to High Records in Memphis and recorded some of it. Some of it they did in the Kansas City area. And one of the others we have is Lee Harris. We'll play a cut of Lee Harris next.
Make me want it,
So what I find really fascinating, probably about Forte as much as anything, of the body of work from a Kansas City label standpoint for an industry that had been really suppressed for a very long time, and you've got civil rights happening in the 60s, and you have people really believing that anything is possible, and out of that, and with some success from Marva Whitney, that a label was able to emerge and actually try to shop artists around the country. And this label, it surprises me for a label that I virtually didn't know much about to the last several years, that the intersections between the jazz and blues artists in this town kept bringing me back to Forte, but it was more of the Underground Railroad, or excuse me, Underground movement of a guy like James Trotter or Dante or Chuck Haddocks, these kind of people that just knew so much about the Forte story. So it's going to be really fabulous to see it come out in August. We're really sad that Marva's not going to be here to see it. Marva had asked me all of last year, her and her son, to work on it. They'd had such bad experiences with James Brown and never getting paid through Forte. They had reissued Daddy Don't Know About Sugar Bear through Excello and not received any royalties from it. And she just didn't want to be taken advantage of again. And I will tell you, they had worked with them for a couple of years prior to them asking me to help. And we spent better part of a year negotiating a contract that Marva was extremely, extremely forthcoming that she wanted all the artists of the compilation to receive the royalties. So they created a contract that they're going to pay absolutely everybody. We asked them for plenty of references, and they could not find any bad references where they hadn't done what they said they'd do, and they paid substantial royalties to several people. And the end result was, after 8-9 months, we were able to come up with a contract that Numero was good with, and that Marva and her son Ellis Taylor, Sherry's brother, was good with, and the Forte Records will see the light of day and get itself around the world, and look for it to come out August 16th. And been my extreme honor to be here with you today. Chuck Haddocks is one of my biggest heroes, as well as Jim O'Neill, and I'm a record collector myself, and am deeply in debt to what you all do in this room, which is preserve sound. One of my favorite passions in the world is recordings.